This is a podcast from the Refugee Study Centre. To learn more about our work, please visit www.rsc.ox.ac.uk.
Thank you very much, Catherine, and thank you for inviting me today. So, I became interested in this topic of unlawful or wrongful convictions of asylum seekers as part of my broader research on immigration crimes. And as part of this research on immigration crime, I work with court files and hearings in a magistrate court and a crown court examining cases involving immigrants convicted for, prosecuted and convicted for a range of immigration-based offenses. And very often the issue of asylum came arise in these cases, both as an issue of immunity, so a defense to the criminal charge, but most often than that as an issue of mitigation, so the asylum case was put forward by the defense as an issue of mitigation for in the sentencing stage. So I'm going to talk about, my presentation is going to be divided into three. The first part, I'm going to look at what is the background to the problem, and many of you who have followed the development in the law in this field might find this this introduction a bit basic, but I just want to make clear that for those who are not familiar with this area of the law, just want to make sure. And particularly, I'm going to look at the decision in Adimi. The second part of the presentation is looking at what happened after Adimi and the legal reform that was pushed after Adimi with the introduction of Section 31 in the 1999 Act. And in particular, I'm going to review in which ways, so in terms of quantitatively speaking, how many of cases of wrongful conviction have been detected, and also what are the problems in the law that allow for these wrongful convictions to happen. And the last part, as a conclusion, I am going to talk. I'm going to give what I think are perhaps remedies for ameliorating the likelihood of mistakes. So, in the mid-1990s, human rights NGOs started to alert it about a pattern of prosecutions of people who were entering the UK, either to enter the UK or in transit to another country, most usually North America. These people claim asylum or intended to claim asylum in another country and were prosecuted for various offenses, most usually offenses related with the use of false documents. So what these human rights organizations, especially Amnesty, pointed out is that practice of prosecution that started in the 1990s, before then, usually people claiming asylum would be admitted provisionally into the country or awaiting for the decision to be made, right, or removed straight away if there were no basis for an application for asylum. But since the 90s, this pattern of prosecutions were denounced by NGOs as breaching, as potentially breaching the or compromising the UK government international obligations under the Refugee Convention, particularly Article 31, which prescribe that member states, contracting states, should not impose penalties on refugees for entering the country or remaining in a country illegally, as long as they come directly to the country from which they are persecuted, and they show good cause for their illegal entry, and they are presented themselves without delay to the authorities. So this practice of prosecution of asylum seekers was challenged before the Divisional Court in 1999. And as a result, the Divisional Court passed the decision in Adimi. The decision in Adimi comprised four distinct appeals cases. The case involving Mr. Adimi, who was an Algerian asylum seeker who came from through Italy using false passports. The case of Sorani, who was an Iraqi Kurdish, also asylum seeker, who was trying to get to Canada to claim asylum. And a couple, Mr. Kasiu and Mrs. Kasiu from Albania, also asylum seekers trying to get to Canada. And they were all prosecuted for the use of false documents. So the Divisional Court first identified an institutional problem that in the first place allowed this practice of prosecution. And this institutional problem consists in the fact that there was a division of labor going on. On the one hand, the Secretary of State was in charge of determining whether or not of granting or not asylum or refugee status. And on the other hand, the CPS, the Crown Prosecution Service, was in charge on determining whether or not that person was immune from punishment under Article 31. But, of course, because there was no incorporation in domestic legislation of Article 31, then lawyers, criminal lawyers, prosecutors have no knowledge about the existence of this immunity. I'm going to come to this institutional issue later on in my presentation. So what did the decision of Adimi decide? And why is it so crucial? It interpreted Article 31 and provide a very generous interpretation in terms of who is protected by Article 31. It's not only refugees, but presumptive refugees or good faith asylum seekers. As to the issue of how the coming directly requirement, which is, as we are going to see, a very contentious requirement and confusing, allowing an element of choice of asylum seekers in their chosen place where they want to make a claim for asylum, And third, as to the interpretation of the requirement of without delay, saying that it is not necessary that the asylum claimants claim asylum at just when they arrive at the port of entry, but within a short time after arrival. And in relation to what to do with that Article 31, more crucial decision, both Lord Justice Brown and Lord Justice Newman favor what they call a Secretary of State solution. So in their view, Article 31 was a matter for the executive to decide and not for the court, as the respondents in the case of Vladimir were arguing. Lord Justice Brown, for instance, argued that decisions on immunity should depend more upon considerations arising out of the proper administration and control of immigration and asylum, rather than upon the need to suppress and punish criminal activity generally. And Lord Justice Newman interpreted the immunity in Article 31 as an issue of immunity, as an issue of executive pardon that has to be given by the Secretary of State. So in case where a prosecution is pursued and there is an issue of immunity under 31, Lord Justice Newman said that that prosecution should be stayed and the decision should be referred to the Secretary of State. So the remedy suggested by the Lord Justice did not imply a reform of the law. So it could be accommodated within the existing law as an issue that should be resolved, both the issue of the asylum determination and the immunity under 31 should be determined by the Secretary of State. However, the Parliament decided that that was not a good solution and made Article 31 a defense to a criminal charge in what is today's Section 31 of the Immigration and Asylum Act 1991. So what is the problem with this with this provision? The fact that it makes a defense for a criminal charge, the Article 31, actually leave the decision on immunity on the prosecution and the judiciary. So both organs who have very limited knowledge about immigration and asylum law. And the second problem is that it allowed actually a prosecution to progress without a determination on the asylum case. Right, so it can be there can and it happened quite frequently that people are prosecuted and convicted for their illegal entry, and then before their asylum case is determined. So this kind of solution, a legal solution. Does not help to resolve that institutional problem identified in ADIMI, okay, of this discrete and decisions on the one side from the Secretary of State and on the other by the CPS and the judiciary. A second problem with Section 31 is that contra ADIMI, it makes very restrictive this requirement of the coming directly from the country of prosecution, because it only exempts people who does not come directly when they could not have expected that to receive protection in that country in which they stop. So in only that circumstance, they would be exempted to comply with this coming directly requirement. And another important limitation is that, again, contra ademi required that the claim is done as soon as was reasonably practicable after his or her arrival. Remember that ademi made that requirement much more flexible. And a final limitation is that Section 31 only applies for a limited number of offences. So offences related to forgery, offences related to possession of false identity documents. And crucially, it does not apply in the Section 2 offence, which is an offence that was incorporated in the Asylum and Immigration Treatment of Claimants Act 2004 and penalised entering to the UK without a passport. Until then, until 2004, people who hold a false document or adulterated document could be prosecuted, but people who had no document at all could not be prosecuted because they were not considered illegal entrance. So what Section 2 does is criminalize those cases. Yet the refugee defense does not cover these people prosecuted for the Section 2 defense. And one of the justifications for not covering these defendants is that the government said that people who hide their identity or destroy their identity should not be protected under Article 30, under Section 31. Although you can argue that if the case fall in Article 31, so if people without passports can prove that they are escaping prosecution and they are trying to enter the country illegally, they can claim immunity under Article 31, under the international protection. So this defense, this offense, sorry, contains their own defenses, which is basically that the defendant has to prove a reasonable excuse for not holding a passport, has to produce a false passport used during the journey, or has to prove that he or she never held a passport. These defenses are really difficult to interpret, and there has been conflicting case law in this regard, and perhaps this is one of the reasons why they are not usually raised in the courts. And as a consequence, many of the people defendants prosecuted for Section 2 offence are convicted. So in my sample of cases, which comprised 159 defendants, 155 defendants were convicted for this offence, so 97% of them. So, now coming back to section 31 and the promise made in the debates in Parliament about section 31 being a protection to against wrongful convictions of good faith asylum seekers. That was a promise made by the then Attorney General. It seems, though, that that promise is not very much reflected in practice, because there have been a number of decisions by the Court of Appeal in which it quashed convictions because they were unsafe. And part of these decisions were triggered by the work of the Criminal Cases Review Commission, which is an independent body depending on the Ministry of Justice, and was created in 1997. And it is tasked with reviewing, examining cases of miscarriages of justice. And one of the set of cases that the commission started to investigate was cases involving wrongful convictions of asylum seekers. And even though the set of cases that the review is quite small, they diagnosed in one of the annual reports that such cases reveal a significant and potentially widespread misunderstanding or abuse of the law. And I'm very grateful to Adam Barnes and Yewa Holiday for the data that they gave me about these cases. So the commission has, since its creation in 1997, referred 21 cases to the Court of Appeal. 18 of these cases were successful in the Court of Appeal. Two of them are still awaiting a decision, and one of them was withdrawn. So basically, all the cases that were sent to the commission, the Court of Appeal, had a favorable decision, and the convictions were quashed, except for three. These were cases involving both Section 31 defense and Section 2 defense, so cases involving possession of false documents and entering to the country without a document. But it's also important to bear in mind that this is the tip of the iceberg, really. The vast majority of the cases end up in the lower court. They are not appealed, and hence we don't know if there is more. And this is just a sample of cases in which the lawyers were very proactive and took the convictions to the Criminal Cases Review Commission. So there's surely be more. In fact, the commission have 80 more cases under review. 86 cases under review. So in part because of the work of the commission and lawyers who appeal wrongful convictions, we have in the last few years important decisions by the Court of Appeal in three cases. The first one is the case of Abdallah Mohammed and others, which is a conjoint appeal of four cases, all of them involving possession of false documents. In all cases, the defendant pleaded guilty and were convicted. in all cases the defendant claim asylum, and in all cases except for one, the case of Abdallah Mohammed, the asylum case was successful, so there was a refugee was granted in three cases. And the decision of the Court of Appeal was to quash the convictions in these three cases in which the refugee status was granted. I'm going to look a little bit more about the case in which the refugee status was not granted. But one of the points that the Court of Appeal made was the lack of good legal advice, and because the lawyers did not advise correctly on the availability of the defense under Section 31. A similar remark was made in the case of Adam last year, a case involving a person who pleaded guilty to two counts of possession of a false passport with intent. He was granted refugee status, and his conviction was quashed. And the last case of this jurisprudence is the case of Mateta, which appeared last summer, a case involving five appeals. Four of them were referred by the Criminal Cases Review Commission. All of the appellants were convicted for possession of false documents with intent, trying to enter the UK or trying to get into another country, to Canada, actually. They all plead guilty, and they were convicted. So the case of Mateta is important because of three aspects. The first aspect is that the judgment clarified what this coming directly requirement involves. It is the fact that the defendant stopped in another country is not necessarily fatal, but it could be explained as a mere stopover into that country, so following the Adimi interpretation. And also, if the defendant could not have expected to be given protection in that country, so following the statutory interpretation of Section 31. So in these two different circumstances. A second important point is a clarification on the burden of proof rules. And it rules that the Court of Appeal rules that the defendant has a burden of an evidential burden to prove that he or she is a refugee, except if there is an adverse decision of the Secretary of State on his or her refugee application, in which case the person has a legal burden to prove on balance of probability that she or he is a refugee. Secondly, there is a legal burden on the defendant to prove that all the requirements of Section 31 are fulfilled. So the coming directly requirement, the fact that he presented her to the authorities without delay, he had good cause, he made an asylum claim as soon as was reasonable, as was reasonably practical. So that is important because there was a lot of uncertainty about what the defendant has and has not to prove. And the third point of importance is that is established a duty on legal advisors to advise their clients about the existence and the scope of Section 31. These instructions, this legal instruction has to be written down, had to be noted. And if the representatives fail to advise on Section 31, then the court is going to examine whether or not a Section 31 defense would have been viable in the case. And in order to assess that likelihood, the Court of Appeal can rely on the assessment of the first tier tribunal, which is the immigration tribunal. Now, what are the main drawbacks of this decision? What did the Court of Appeal not say? I think that although the Court of Appeal clarified the coming directly requirement, it still leaves great uncertainty on lawyers, for instance, on what is or what constitutes a mere stopover. So, for example, if we look at the cases of Mr. Bashir, one of the defendant, the applicant in the case of Mateta, he stayed a month in Kenya. Right, that was considered a mere stopover, not preventing the application of Section 31. The case of the couple, also the couple in the in Matita, Mr. Gabami and Mrs. Afshar, husband and wife, Iranians, husband and wife, who traveled through Thailand, Tanzania, Kenya, and Madrid. They stay in Thailand 2 months. They stay in Tanzania 20 days. They stay in Kenya 1 week, and in Madrid 20 days. So these were considered mere stopovers, not precluding the protection of Section 31. However, on the other hand, the case of Abdallah Mohammed, the first one in which he was not, his conviction was not declared unsafe, in part because of his stopover in Italy. He stayed in Italy 1.5 days. He couldn't speak English. He was under control of an agent who control the trip arrangements, and the court of appeal held that quite probably his defense would not have been successful if run. Now this leaves some uncertainty in the law if the coming directly requirement relied on facts, then there's a great scope for inconsistency in the law. And I ask why and what are the main difference between the cases of Mr. Bashir, and the Iranian couple on the one hand, in which the conviction was quashed, and the case of Abdallah Mohammed, in which the conviction was not quashed. A second question that the Court of Appeal did not fully resolve is the issue of this institutional gap that Adimi, institutional problem that Adimi identified. Because it is quite clear that when there is an asylum decision, either granting asylum or rejecting asylum, the rules of evidence could lead to either an application of Section 31 or a non-application of Section 31. The fact is that most of the cases are as I was explaining before, most of the cases that reach the court, the criminal cases, do not have a decision on the asylum application made. So the Court of Appeal does not resolve this issue. Okay? So in most cases, people with an extant asylum claim can be convicted. Even though there's no resolution on the substantive claim. And the third point of criticism of this decision is the excessive emphasis these three decisions place on the role of defense lawyers. Yes, defense lawyers have a duty to advise their clients on the availability of a defense, but I argue that because the final decision on immunity under Section 31 is put by the legal structure created by Section 31 on the prosecution, then there should be more emphasis on the role of the prosecution of allowing these cases to go into the court, into the criminal system in the first place. So I am going to talk just almost finishing my presentation, but I'm going to talk before about how these decisions are done in practice and how those deficiencies that I identified in the law that the Court of Appeal failed to solve impact on the practice of how these cases are processed. So the asylum application, an asylum application can work as a gate opener for a prosecution. It means that cases involving immigration offenses are predominantly dealt with through administrative action, i.e. removal, okay? But in cases in which the person cannot be removed, very often because there is an asylum application put forward, then that application for asylum is a gate opener for prosecution. Okay? At the same time, the asylum application can be a close to the gate for a criminal investigation. Okay? A report by John Byrne, the inspector of the UK Border Force, on the investigation of immigration offences in port of entries found that most of the cases that do not get to the police, most of the cases of immigration offences, say, for instance, deception, possession of false documents, and no documents. One of the main reasons for not getting through the system, through the criminal justice system, is because of statutory defenses. Okay, so in that way, the asylum application is also closing the gate for the advance of these cases into the criminal justice system. So what we have there is the sort of mass of gray cases, which are in which a clear application of a statutory defense is not available. Okay, and in that decision is made by immigration officers with the supervision of the chief immigration officers. And they don't assess whether an asylum application is going to be successful, but they just assess whether a defense under Section 31 might be viable. Okay? And in this regard, there's new guidelines from December of 2013 after the Matita case, in which caseworkers are given much more detailed rules about how to go on and do this preliminary assessment. And I think they are much better than the older guidelines, the asylum policy guidelines of 2006. And they incorporate this more generous coming directly requirement as interpreted by the Court of Appeal in Matita. So if the immigration staff decide that a defense under Section 31 or Section 2 is not viable, then they refer the case to the police and then to the prosecution. The fact is that preliminary assessment, even though the Crown Prosecution Service has the final say on whether or not Section 31 applies, that preliminary assessment by immigration officers is quite crucial, okay, for the prosecution. And they follow it unless there is any problem in the assessment. One of the most important issues in that decision is whether or not the person stops in another country. Again, the coming directly requirement. If my experience of looking at these cases in the magistrate court is that when there is a stopover, even short stopover, Section 31 is rejected. Section 31 defense is rejected. And then what happens is that the CPS evaluates the case based on the usual evidential and public interest test, and the case goes to the criminal justice system, enter the criminal justice system. I don't have experience of looking at cases of false passports. I looked mainly at cases of no passports in which Section 31 does not apply. But my experience is that these are very short proceedings. Everything happened in around 5-10 minutes. There are very short hearings. The prosecution presents the case. The defense lawyer advises the clients to plead guilty to the charge, especially if there is an issue of the coming directly point. And in very, very few cases, defenses are raised. So in only 7 out of 159 defendants, there was a defense raised for offenses under Section 2. Even though 41 of these defendants claim or intended to claim asylum. And because these are cases that are resolved outside the rules of the adversarial process, then the judges and the magistrate are limited to ratified that decision that was made between the parties. And issues of asylum are dealt with, if at all, in the sentencing stage, so as issues of mitigation. So what are the problems? Why are these defenses raised so rarely? One possibility is that the immigration service does a good job in filtering out cases that are undeserving. So all the cases that reach the court actually don't have any defenses available, although the work of the Criminal Cases Review Commission seems to suggest the opposite. It seems that one of the problems is this very strict and narrow interpretation of the coming directly requirement, which if the defendant stop in another country, which is very often the case, many people travel through different countries because of following directions of smugglers or agents. And so this is a very common pattern in these cases. A second problem that I identified and I talked about is that when there is an asylum application that is successful, very often these cases are just discontinued because it's not in the public interest to prosecute them. But they are very rare. I just identified two cases in which that happened. It's very rare that a decision on the asylum case is done before the criminal case is decided. Another factor is the lack of knowledge by criminal lawyers about immigration law. But also in that lack of knowledge, there's a factor of uncertainty about what the law requires or not. So in many instances, lawyers are uncertain about running a defense that is deemed to be unsuccessful. So for instance, in my sample of cases, I identify cases in which Somali nationals were not prosecuted because they didn't have passports, and the prosecution considered that they have a reasonable excuse not to have passports because there's no passport issuing facilities in Somalia. But in other cases, Somalis were prosecuted under Section 2 offense. Okay. There's also uncertainty about whether a stopover precludes protection or not. So again, cases in which it precludes protection, most of them. perhaps the decision in Mateta would help to clarify that, although because of that reliance on the factual basis of each case, I think it left a lot of uncertainty on whether that is going to be so. And another factor that militates against a profound examination of the factual and legal issues involved in these cases is that these proceedings are so brief, so minimalist, that they are processed in a very bureaucratic way. They don't allow a proper examination, a proper discussion of the facts. These are very often very complex cases and are dealt with as in a kind of bureaucratic way. So now, given the problems identified, what would constitute a solution or a remedy for the continuation of cases in which convictions are passed when they shouldn't be passed? One, the best solution would be a change in the law, and going back to the decision in Adimi, following that Secretary of State solution, placing the decision about immunity in the hands of the Secretary of State, who also would have the responsibility to determine the asylum case. A better solution could be the decriminalization of immigration crimes, which it's very unlikely, but both would require a change of the law. Now, the change of the law, it's quite unlikely, especially in a climate of restrictive measures in the immigration field. So my kind of second best solution is that we focus more on the gatekeepers of the system. And the gatekeepers of the system are immigration staff and the Crown Prosecution Service. So a lot of emphasis has been put on the role of the defense, but it is important that we can get decisions right in the first place, but not by not allowing cases to progress into the criminal justice system. And this is an important argument of international law. So international law binds all the branches of the state, not just the executive. It binds the prosecution, it binds law enforcement officials, and hence they should have a duty to know the law in the first place and investigate where there is a risk of breach international law. But there is also an argument based on the institutional design put forward by Section 31, which places the decision on immunity on the prosecution, the Crown Prosecution Service. And hence, my suggestions would be, along with the work of the CPS in this area for other offenses, so for instance for assisted suicide, for the prosecution of human trafficking, they have published prosecutorial guidelines that give more or less a clear idea about the rules that the prosecution would follow in relation to into cases under examination and whether or not they will proceed with the prosecution or not. And I think these guidelines should apply for immigration offenses in general. It should cover both passport, possession of false passports, but also should cover no passport offenses. They are substantially similar cases and can potentially involve people protected by international law, and should clarify first the requirements in the law, so incorporating the interpretation of Matita, the requirements in the law, which seems to be unclear. It should also make clear that this is in order to give a fair warning about which cases are candidate for prosecution, fair warning for the lawyers, the defense lawyers, but also for the potential suspects. on in which conditions they are going to be liable to prosecution. And second, they should have a duty to investigate these cases. And that would counter the trend for administrativization of the processing of these cases that has been going on. So generally the CPS follow the advice of the immigration officials without looking much into it. I think there is a duty on the prosecution to ensure that, because they are the final decision makers, to ensure that they get a decision right. Even though the immigration service advise a prosecution, and even though there is a guilty plea by the defendant. And finally, I think there should be, as in the guidelines for trafficking, there should be an analysis of whether, even if all the requirements of Section 31 are not fulfilled, there should be a question of whether, in the case of people who are recognized as refugees, it is in the public interest to prosecute those cases. And the public interest should not be based merely on the cost and the expenses of the prosecution, but be based on fairness. Thank you very much.
For more information about the different ways you can stay updated and engaged with the work of the Refugee Study Centre, please visit www.rsc.ox.ac.uk/connect.